Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, Celia Rayburg is here to talk about her new book, Do You Get the Feeling? A Handbook to Facilitate Emotional Awareness and Communication, 150 Ways to Express Yourself. Celia Rayburg is a licensed clinical social worker who resides in Brooklyn, New York. She works as a psychotherapist in clinical and private practice and has taught in undergraduate psychology programs and high school. She enjoys a unique blend of working in the mental health and educational professions. Her experiences with children, teens, and adults of various backgrounds have cultivated her finely tuned sensitivity to the inner psyche. In addition to her clinical practice and teaching, Celia spends her free time working with art and music as ancillary mediums of self-expression. The book, Do You Get the Feeling?, is the first of Celia's literary tools for the mental health practitioner and educator. And I am very much looking forward to finding out more about this really unique book. So thank you for joining us today, Celia.
Well, I'm excited to be here myself.
Well, good. So congratulations. This is actually your first published book, isn't it?
It is. It is.
So, you know, I mentioned it's unique, and this really is. I haven't seen anything like this before. I'm wondering how you came up with the idea for Do You Get the Feeling?
Well, truthfully, different people do different things in their free time, and in my free time, I like to write, just for fun. Sometimes I challenge myself to just write poetry. I was actually sort of in between jobs. I had graduated from social work school, and I was job searching, and I had a lot of free time on my hands. I was working with one private client, that's all I had at the time, and this particular client came my way actually through a very unusual circumstance. She was feeling suicidal, and thank God I was able to stabilize her. But her greatest problem was that she was a closed book. She could not communicate her feelings. She would sit in silence with me. I would ask her the most basic things like, what'd you eat for lunch? And she'd be like, And she was so locked that she was cutting off from her friends, from her family, could not go forward in relationships, and certainly couldn't work in therapy because there was no language. So I thought to myself, maybe we need to use another language. I started bringing her photographs of people with emotional expressions, and I would ask her to identify a photograph that she felt aligned with and talk from there, bounce off of it. Mm-hmm. And then I started to write for her. When we finally got her talking a bit with short sentences and just expressing some pieces of information about herself, I would try to extrapolate a feeling, and I started writing a little bit for her and saying, if I gave you the words, does it make it easier for you to say it? And what I found was the answer is yes. She later on got married about a year and a half later, and she was one of the first people to use my book. She would like keep it on her night table and help her talk to her husband. So it started over there, and I just started writing and writing for fun, every feeling I could possibly think of. And at a certain point, when I was already working as a therapist, I would bring it into the session and we would play with it. And I began to realize that this is a real tool. This is really helpful. Sometimes the picture alone, and sometimes the words alone, and sometimes the blend of pictures and words really helped people connect and find a more deep or complete way to say what they were feeling. So that's where it came from.
So fascinating. What happens in the psyche to cause that disconnect that you're talking about?
It really depends on the person, and it depends on the upbringing. I would say that in some cultures, it's not acceptable to talk about feelings. I think that in a certain sense, the European culture, certainly of years ago, of my parents' and grandparents' generation, is that you don't talk about how you feel. You keep it within. People who've gone through trauma often have repressed feelings, or they will express their feelings in a volatile way or in a way that is kind of off base because they haven't had a proper model of what to do with those intense feelings. And then there's a group of people who have social deficits, such as people along the Asperger spectrum, the PDD, pervasive developmental delay spectrum, who are a little bit awkward with their words, limited social skills, and therefore when they're sitting in company or when something happens to them that's deeply emotional, it's locked inside and they're unable to share it with other people.
Mm. Okay, so your subtitle is A Handbook to Facilitate Emotional Awareness and Communication. I'd like you to describe for listeners what exactly emotional awareness is, what it looks like from somebody.
Okay. Truthfully, if we were to look at emotional awareness, we would really like to visit those who researched and have defined it in its best way scientifically. The concept of emotional awareness dates back. The earliest date of study of emotional awareness or study of emotional intelligence, which means the understanding within oneself of one's feelings, I put it back to the work of Jack Meyer, Peter Salovey, and David Caruso. They were the ones who developed something called the Mesquite, which is the Meyer Salovey Caruso Emotional Intelligence Test. They were one of the first researchers to find interest in the fact that some people are highly emotionally alert and aware, and other people lack emotional awareness. Emotional awareness has many different facets within it, whether it's understanding my own feelings or reading someone else's feelings. You know, from the youngest age, a young baby, an infant, will begin to recognize its mother's face, and when the mother's face begins to smile, the baby will imitate that smile. Or if the mother's face registers anger or the tone of her voice is harsh, then the baby will become tense because it's aware that there's anger or there's some displeasure in the mother. So emotional awareness really begins from infancy, and it develops over time. Those people who are highly emotionally aware are not necessarily those who are able to manage emotions. There's some people who, for example, have attention deficit hyperactive disorder, whether they are children or adults, and they're very aware of emotions, but they're distracted by them, and sometimes they get overwhelmed by them. They can't concentrate because, for example, I'm feeling nervous right now, so I cannot take the test in front of me. I can't read the words because my body is not feeling calm.
Mm-hmm.
People who are experts in emotional awareness are experts not because of awareness, but because of management, meaning they're not afraid of their emotions. They can touch them. They can recognize them, and they know how to utilize them in a way that works. Politicians and people who have a lot of charisma are masters of emotional awareness because they understand their own emotions. They know how to play with them, display them kind of when they're putting on a show in order to evoke emotions in their audience.
Mm-hmm.
So they are masters of emotional awareness and emotional management. But most of us are not drama queens and don't have those skills of turning on and off emotions within ourselves or within others. And some days were better, some days were worse. So that's pretty much, I guess, what emotional awareness would involve. The understanding of how I feel, knowing what to do with it, how to calm it down or how to express it or how to enjoy the feeling, and also knowing how to read other people's feelings.
It's interesting that being able to read someone else's feelings is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Is a part of one's own emotional awareness. Now, I'm wondering if there is a sort of, you know, quote-unquote, normal developmental pattern of emotional intelligence that you see.
Well, I haven't really done or included the research about emotional development as it sort of develops from stage to stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that with Ericksonian stages of development, perspective that as we master different parts of our lives, we grow within ourselves. I would say that our emotional awareness as young children versus teenagers versus young adults versus middle-aged and elderly people should intensify, which is why I guess that we respect elderly people. We look at them as sages, those whom we can go to for advice, because their life experience has deepened their feelings about the world and about themselves. So those that are our leadership in the community, I think we look towards them because we believe they possess the highest levels of emotional awareness. They're the ones who can respond most effectively to guide those that are younger than them or those that have less experience. So I would say that emotional awareness comes with experience, assuming that the experience has not been hampered by, as you said, trauma,
yeah,
or early childhood abuse, where there hasn't been modeling of how to be, how to show your emotions. And number three, that the person developmentally does not have some sort of delay, like a social deficit, like autism or et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel then that say there was some trauma in childhood, do you think it's possible at a later date in adulthood for that adult to be able to fully feel their feelings and have that emotional awareness? I mean, obviously it is a process, but from your experience, do you see that there is a complete healing that can happen in this realm?
That's a great question. There are different types of trauma. A traumatic incident can be a one-time occurrence, but it could be so great and so redirecting of the entire life energies that it can redefine the entire person, such as someone who may have witnessed a bombing.
Mm.
Someone might have seen a car crash in front of them, someone who may have been kidnapped. Even if something were a one-time occurrence, it depends how deeply traumatized the person was. And their experiences before they were traumatized will indicate how healthy they can be when they try to heal. If they were healthy individuals beforehand and had good coping skills, which also translates into good emotional awareness, ability to feel their feelings, express them, share them with other people, and relieve them when they're painful, then the chances of them recovering from trauma are high. Those people who have recurrent trauma, such as those that live in abusive relationships, whether it's being physically abused or being neglected, and the trauma impacts itself time and again, obviously this inhibits the person's ability to return to their healthy self. Is it impossible? No. Usually, if they are removed from a situation or at a different point of their lives where they feel a sense of safety and security, then they can definitely re-explore their feelings and teach themselves that it's okay to feel.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes a lot more work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sensitivity that's involved in releasing the trauma without re-traumatizing the person as they reawaken those memories.
That's a great point. You know, and with your book, I know it has so many applications, but I imagine in a case of that with trauma that's gone on repetitively,
mm-hmm,
that this would be a fantastic way for a person in that situation to get back in touch with their feelings and emotions.
Well, I actually have one of my write-ups dedicated to this very idea that it's hard to open up something painful, and there's like a process of kind of like unpeeling the mask on the face or opening up a creaky, rusty door. But that ultimately it's worth it, but it is hard. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to take a moment to share that with our audience?
Sure. And I really want, because we're getting along in the interview, I want to really have you describe what your book, how you have laid out your book and designed it and the emotions and feelings that you describe in it. So maybe if you want to describe your book and then give us the example that you're talking about.
A couple samples?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. The book begins with a number of introductory pages, which include a colorful table of contents that's laid out in 32 different groups of emotions, so kind of you can spot your emotion quickly, such as the group called cheerful, a group called lazy, a group called dependent, nervous, relaxed, burdened, abused, accomplished, etc. And each group has a picture next to it, because many people will find their picture rather than their word.
Mm.
And next to that picture, the table of contents will include a couple of titles in that group. Because, for example, let's say group number 31 of being upset and sad has this cute little baby that seems like it's screeching at the top of its lungs. And then there's a couple of subtitles. There's sore, there's gloomy, there's moody, there's temperamental, there's sad, there's hurt, and there's crushed. So you see that it sort of goes along the lines of how intense is the sadness? Are you just kind of in a bad mood or are you deeply crushed? And the way that the book is used is that we start off by just handing someone the book and saying, how do you feel today? Or by stopping a discussion and saying, let's look for that feeling in the book. And usually I will spot or help the client spot or the group that I'm working with to spot more than one title. And then we're going to go to the group page, which is a lovely, colorful cover sheet to each group. And the colors do somewhat represent the feeling. There's a picture on the cover sheet, and then there's the subtitles. For example, I'm looking at the group called Number 7, Dependent, and it has dependent, lonely, and a higher level of feeling too alone. And there's this picture of this little boy looking up at the sky like someone left him behind.
Mm.
And we then go and open up that little group, and usually I encourage the reader to read more than one out loud, because then they can sort of compare what they're feeling. Am I feeling nervous or am I feeling desperate? And you can target much better exactly what you're feeling. When we read things out loud, sometimes I read, people like to listen, sometimes they read. I always encourage people to adapt the poem. You want to put your name in the poem. You want to put your dad's name in the poem. You want to write it as a she versus a he. You want to give some more examples. It's really just to jumpstart people. And if we're on a negative poem, such as I'm looking at a group called Abused, if we're reading something called Used and Abused, it's a very painful poem, and it may touch a very raw feeling that the individual is experiencing. Well, we're not going to hide the feeling. We'll explore it. We'll talk about it. And then we'll move on from there to a better page of, well, what's the opposite of being used or abused? What would you want to feel, such as, I feel safe, I feel accepted, I feel I belong, I feel like I trust you. And we move to a better page that we read out loud, and we create a visualization of that and how we can get there. And sometimes I'll photocopy that page to give to a person to take home and to practice with over the week as their source of inspiration. So that's pretty much how it's used. And since there's so many different groups, it can be applied in so many different experiences.
Absolutely. You know, I think one really valuable there are many, but one valuable aspect to this is the fact that you have real pictures. I mean, I think of sort of similar ideas I've seen over the years, and mostly they are a little cartoon face. With, you know, that's associated with...
How do you feel today?
Yes, exactly. I mean, who hasn't seen that? But, you know, this just puts it into such a more realistic context than that old cartoon that we've all seen, you know? So I think that is just fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I hope people enjoy that.
Yeah. So did you draw from a known therapeutic model for this whole idea?
Nope, I did not. I just went at it, and then I began sharing it with colleagues and friends, and we realized that 150 poems in one big stack was very hard to work through, so then we started subdividing it, and then grouping it very specifically where a group like Traumatized and Shocked will be right near the group called Healing, so that you can find the soothing experience right nearby to help you out. And then I decided that it really should be colorful. The color itself talks to people. It expresses a feeling within itself.
Yeah.
I went with that.
So the poetry, the prose, it's more prose, right?
It's prose. I did not want it to rhyme because I wanted it to be very natural language. Like, this is what I'd really say.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are the write-ups that,
right,
that are in there. Okay. Okay. So this kind of book is more targeted for the mental health field and a practitioner rather than a layperson, or do you see like it crossing a lot of different lines?
Interestingly, I actually just sent out two books to friends of mine, one who directs a large nonprofit organization and another just colleague that I happen to know.
Mm-hmm.
They are not therapists. They don't do anything of the sort. And I got this squealing, excited response in my voicemail this week. I love it! It's fantastic! I'm not going to sleep tonight!
Mm-hmm.
And that was very exciting for me to hear because the language itself in the book is very beautiful and very enriching. Anyone who enjoys literature or poetry or who does any work with writing will find a benefit in this, either because of their own enjoyment or because it will serve as a certain model for them in a writing style.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the places that I did a presentation for was a shelter, a women's shelter, mm-hmm. and the director of the shelter took a look at the book and she said to me, I think this should go into high schools as a tool for composition and creative writing.
Oh, that's a good
The
one.
Language is so phenomenal.
Yeah.
In fact, when I did a presentation at a hotel, the waitresses from the kitchen came out to take a look at it. And one of them actually belonged to a drama club, and she was going for theater. She bought the book. She first read it to the whole kitchen
mm-hmm.
with expression and drama, and she actually performed some of the write-ups in her church.
Oh, wow.
So this was a very good exercise for her to learn how to put herself into other people's shoes and feel and empathize for them. Mm-hmm. So anyone who works with drama, teaches acting, or does anything with the English language would enjoy this as well.
That's a very good point. You know, you broke the emotions up into 32 groups, but I believe it's 150 different emotions
mm-hmm.
that you basically describe.
Right.
I mean, I think really most of us, most people maybe have a sort of a grouping of 10 emotions that we can name, that we can deal with. And this just expands. I mean, it's expanding one's world, really, when you look at maybe 10 versus 150.
Thank you. You know, I think that some of our day-to-day activities are really primitive. We haven't really gone beyond what we learned as children. And as a young child, a 7-year-old knows those 10 emotions. I'm sad, I'm angry, mm-hmm. I'm jealous, I'm happy. Perhaps they know the feeling of love and hate, but it's very primitive, and they are limited with their choices how to use those words, as well as how they would describe what that feels like. But as we grow older, we want to become more refined in our exact use of words, especially when we're trying to communicate to a spouse or to a child what exactly we're feeling. We are angry that they didn't clean their room, or we are frustrated that now we have to do it ourselves. There's a great difference. Are we disappointed that they were irresponsible, or are we worried that they're going to get sick because it's filthy?
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very different, and that's a much more mature, expansive use of the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Celia Raber, author of Do You Get the Feeling? A Handbook to Facilitate Emotional Awareness and Communication. You can find out more about Celia through her website, www.doyougetthefeeling.com.
So, in truth, when I began writing the book, I was aware of those smiley charts and feeling bingo. I actually use it in my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I thought to myself, there's nothing for the adult or for the teenager that would express emotions that are a little more complicated than a smiley face. And that's when I thought to myself, this is really a book for the young or older adult because this has metaphors. I'll share with you some examples. It draws from real life symbols and attaches that to emotions so that it becomes very, very real when we express ourselves. And there's one of the questions I often get about the book is, you know, when you work with someone and you're talking about painful or strong emotions, doesn't it make them feel angrier or sadder or more afraid? And the answer is actually no.
Mm-hmm.
Because once a person identifies emotion and expresses it in words, it has been released from the body simply by verbalizing. And certainly if you're working with a teacher or a therapist, a guidance counselor, if it's a negative emotion that they're verbalizing, you obviously help them onward.
Definitely.
Don't leave them there.
Yeah.
But often reading it alone, patients have said to me, wow, that's terrific. That's exactly how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's nothing more to be said. They said it already. It's out. Done with. They can move on.
Yeah.
They can move on.
Well, what happens when that emotion or feeling is locked in the body and isn't allowed to be expressed? How does that manifest in one's life?
Well, I think it depends what the emotion is.
Okay.
If it's nervousness and it's a little child, you might see hyperactivity. It's kind of bursting out of the seam.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when the feeling is emptiness or dissatisfaction, I think that you might see the person breathing heavily. And eventually, obviously, negative emotions that are not expressed become illnesses, whether they're ulcers, mm-hmm. high blood pressure, depression. And our goal really is to be healthy individuals, alive with our emotions, able to recognize them, knowing what to do with them, and feeling safe enough to share it.
You know, you have said, I've read somewhere, that you say it's impossible to arrive at change or improved mood unless you've cleaned out a person's distorted feelings and thought patterns. And I would like to know how this book takes them through that with the pictures, with the prose, and into the more positive aspect of their feelings, you know, that you talk about in this book as well. What is that bridge? How do they get there?
Okay. Again, everybody is so different. Each example stands on its own, but let's use an example. I'm holding the book in my hand, and I'm going to look at a page called Stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphors that we're using for stubborn are, I stand tall, towering over saplings in a forest, so large and tall and expansive. Even a highway of cars, a herd of buffaloes could not overrun me. I am like a brick wall, and don't even talk to me. Don't start. I'm a locked fence. Suppose we were talking to a parent and a child, and there was some conflict going on between them, where the child, for example, was asking for allowance in order to buy some snack at school, and the dad was just completely refusing, okay? And there was a conflict that ensued after this where the child, for example, I don't know, went into the dad's pocket and took $5 without permission, and, of course, that was called highway robbery.
Mm.
So suppose we were trying to bring an understanding between this dyad, this father and son, okay? I might meet with the father separately, because this might embarrass the child, and say to him, when you say no to your child, right, what is the reason for saying no? Where is it coming from? What feeling? Is it coming from a feeling of I'm the father and I'm stubborn and don't talk to me and this is my way? Is it coming from the feeling of this is not good for my child? And suppose the father would land on this page and say, I'm stubborn. He lives with me and too bad, I am stubborn. And I'd say, okay, well, let's read out what stubborn feels like. And I would bring the child back in and say, listen quietly while your father reads out stubborn. And then I would turn to the child and say, when your father does not allow you to speak and ask your requests and whatever he says, the answer is automatically no because he's the father, how do you feel? And then I would have the child choose a page. Chances are that the child will pick a page of a group called Stifled Misunderstood, like as if the image on that page is as if you put a gag and, you know, I'm roped up and I can't open my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that would bring to a discussion between the parent and child of how it feels when I'm asked something which I don't agree with versus how does it feel when I can't open my mouth because I'm not allowed to talk. And is there any other way to communicate between the father and son?
That is a great tool, and this is where this is how this book can really, really facilitate communication with any kind of a relationship, really.
One of the other ways that it can be used is in abusive relationships. Sometimes we might meet with abusers in a group and present a story to them and try to teach them empathy. People who are sociopaths, people who have antisocial behaviors often don't realize the pain that they're inflicting onto others.
Mm.
They're not in tune. They're so selfishly absorbed in what they're saying that or doing that they completely shut out what the other person feels like when they receive it on the other end. So suppose we brought in a couple of scenarios or even video clippings to show of an abusive setup, of an abusive conversation, an abusive activity. Then we would have the abuser identify what does the other person feel like. And this type of a book would force them to read it out loud.
Mm.
Play the role of the battered woman. Play the role of the teenager who was mugged. What do they feel like? Go into their bodies. Mm. And that can create a little bit of an opening in the minds of abusers.
There is a possibility for someone that may be labeled a sociopathic personality to actually be able to learn their emotion like this.
That is one of the most tricky populations
to
deal with.
Yeah.
Most of the people that we know who have not come towards true criminal activity are people who are doing activities without self-control, without good judgment, or who are playing out earlier scenarios in their own lives where they were abused and therefore they're going out to hurt others. And those are people who, if we catch them or work with them early enough or when they're motivated, can certainly develop empathy, can certainly understand themselves better. For example, you might say to them, what caused you, what feeling did you feel when that happened to you? Do you remember a time in your life where someone hurt you? And you will find that generally anyone who has abusive qualities has themselves been a victim somewhere in their life. And so this book can uncover the underlying feelings which might be causing them to retaliate and hurt others. And once they can understand and release and forgive those feelings of being hurt themselves, then hopefully they can control themselves and stop hurting other people. And there's certainly a lot of groups in this book about not feeling safe or feeling abused or traumatized or shocked or dissociated or being shy and avoidant or misunderstood. There's many negative feelings. But I must add to the audience, I balanced the book because I certainly did not want this book to be 80% negative and 20% happy feelings.
Right.
There are lots of fantastic, exciting groups, such as a group called Appreciation, a group called Lucky, a group called Satisfied, a group called Loving. There's wonderful, hopeful, and really satisfying write-ups in this book that are wonderful to read when you finally hit that page and say, today I am on that page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my clients' favorite groups is the group Calm, because that's a group we don't seem to come to very easily.
Right.
And when they land on that page, it's just such a great feeling to be able to read it out loud and say, yes, I'm here, I arrived.
I'm so glad you made that point, because this isn't just a book to pick up, really, when you are in that negative state. I mean, you can pick it up on any given day and really go, even if it is, you know, you're in a positive frame of mind, you're in a positive emotional state, and you can go deeper into that and really express yourself more as a human being by exploring the different aspects of that positive emotion.
Exactly.
I think that's great. As I'm talking to you, I'm realizing that there are so many applications to this book. I know you are trying to get it out there to professionals, to therapists in the mental health profession. But what are you doing to also get this out to the layperson? I mean, are you doing workshops? What are you doing to get this out?
This book is really quite new. It's somewhat in its beginning stages as far as marketing.
Okay.
So I've just begun to do presentations to professional therapists, counselors, supervisors. As I said, I just recently went down to a women's shelter in order to train the therapists there. That was a fascinating experience because their perception of this book was so unique to their to their clientele.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see this going into high schools, and so I think I'm going to be developing a curriculum of how to use this book to teach mental health or to teach about relationships. Even to teach about how to express oneself on a date or how to recognize the warning signs of someone who is not emotionally aware. And that's you know, in process. I have given this to be read by different disciplines, such as speech therapists. Anyone who works with stroke victims or adults who have any speech deficits, this book is very helpful to them. as they relearn language.
Mm-hmm.
I've been finding that people who are immigrants from other countries and are interested to learn the expanded use of American language in a richer way are enjoying this book. I've given this to doctors, physicians, psychiatrists, but it's certainly in the process of being recognized by the public, and whether it's the layman, the teenager. This book was reviewed by a teenager, a lovely 14-year-old, who just read it to be a participating reviewer.
Uh-huh.
And she tried it out with her parents at home. She had a lot of fun with it. She actually, she charted her moods over a week, and every day she landed on different pages, and she was working on her own page to add to the book on the last free-floating page on the last page of the book. But I certainly would like the public to know that this is a book which anyone can really use to enhance their own understanding of self, their own relationships with their kids, with their husband. It's great in a classroom discussion. It's great in a support group. And, of course, in a therapeutic setting, that's where it needs to be taught or used in order to heal.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that if survivors of trauma or abuse or, you know, situations where there has been some suffering, they're often very, very disconnected with their mm-hmm. own feelings, and from what I understand, often misinterpret others' feelings. How does that work, and how will your book help a person that often misinterprets another's feelings?
I'd like to expand the question. Many people misinterpret others' feelings, and it's not necessarily as a result of emotional trauma or physical trauma or sexual trauma or verbal trauma. Many people misinterpret others' feelings because of a low level of IQ or because their own parents or siblings or teachers do not model for them how to express emotions in words or in actions properly. And so they grow up with the poor example in front of themselves. They're miscuing. You can see an example of this. I was in session this week, and one of my clients got into big trouble with her friends. The scenario, she was on the school bus, and she sometimes chit-chats with the bus driver. So he said to her, "Can you tell me the names of the children who are eating on this bus?" And so she dutifully turned around and tattletailed on her friends. And when she got off the bus the next day in school, her friends in front of her announced to the entire classroom, "So-and-so is a tattletaler.
Uh-oh.
Don't
sit
next to her."
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Now, she's someone who lacks emotional awareness. She's somewhat immature, and she's certainly not in touch with her own feelings, but she didn't use good judgment because she did not understand the reaction of other people. She chose the bus driver or her friend. Now, she happens to have the most wonderful, dedicated parents that you could wish for. So I couldn't blame it necessarily on the home. This is her personal deficit, where she herself needs to learn to be emotionally aware. And where this book would be helpful is where I would put out scenarios on a table, whether I'm working with a teenager or even an adult, and say, "Situation, you are seated on a bus. The bus driver turns around and says to you, 'Would you please tell me which person on this bus did not pay the fare?' And you who are sitting right near the bus driver would be able to notice that. You have to decide, who are you loyal to?" Now, if you use this book, you could say, "Well, what would the feeling of that person be towards you if you snitched?" And you can find a group in this book, and there's a group here that would be like wrongly accused or exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you were a friend, they might say that the feeling is called hypocritical. So there's a particular group that you would read out loud, and it would help the person to come to a judgment. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to speak out loud if that's the feelings that I'm going to see in the other person?
Good point. That's a great example of a practical use. Do you have a favorite write-up, a favorite prose from this
book? Do I have a favorite?
Yeah.
I think the favorites change from day to day. Depends on my feeling. Hey, some days my favorite is a particular page. It might be hopeful. It might be surviving. It might be proud. It might be accomplished. It might be relaxed. Depends on my day, of course.
Yes, sure.
But I always wish people you should have a happy feeling page.
That's a good point. So is it basically divided 50-50 with more positive emotions and negative emotions?
It actually is divided more like 55
okay.
to 45.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because when we're in a negative state of being, there are so many negative states of being.
Yeah.
And a happy state really is an elevated state where the body feels flowing and calm and stabilized and in equilibrium. In a certain way, when I feel happy, I feel good. I feel safe inside. I feel true to myself. There's only so many ways to say happy, but unfortunately, there are many ways to say sad.
Mm-hmm.
So in a certain sense, there was a little bit more negative grouping. Also because it's harder to express, I took more time to work with it and write it out.
Mm. Now, in the world we're living in today where fear is a huge emotion for people, I mean, we're talking about the economy and war and just various things like that, you know, people are really struggling to survive. There's a lot of deep fears that are being triggered in people. How much did you put into this book regarding different emotions about fear?
There are a couple of sections on that. There's a section called nervous, and then there's a section that I would say is not fear, but it comes into it, and it would be the lazy and confused section, sort of where I'm delaying something because I'm afraid of the reaction or result, or I don't know, I'm unsure of myself.
Mm.
There's a special section called afraid and weak, and there's a section called annoyed, where I'm dissatisfied with something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have a number of sections devoted to that type of a feeling. I'd say about 15 to 20% of the book has examples of different elements of fear.
Of fear, yeah. So was this book easy to get published, Celia?
It was not an easy process for me. As many first-time authors will find, I did face rejection from different publishing companies. And at a certain point, I decided that this is a manuscript which is ready to go. I know it's valuable to people. I'm going to publish it myself. And so I did research, and I chose Author House as in my publishing company. And I think they did a beautiful job. What I liked best about it is that I had the ability to make choices every step along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I chose my photographs. I chose the language. Nothing was changed in it without my explicit permission, and certainly reflects my personal values. That was important to me.
So are you using your book now in your practice?
I do.
Yeah.
I don't say I use it every day or every session.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on what's going on in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But I often keep it on the desk. It's nice and bright and colorful, so it catches people's attention. And at different points in a session, sometimes we'll stop and we'll visit the book.
Yeah. I think it would be a great, you know, used in a session like that, but I just popped in my mind, it would be great on a coffee table in every office, therapist's office, you know, the waiting room, so people can flip through it before one of your sessions. I think it would probably trigger some things, but anyway, that's just something
certainly
that popped in my
I
mind.
I think it needs to be in every student lounge.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah.
Every student lounge, every college campus. Because teenagers, for the most part, are the ones who struggle intensely with confused emotions, too many emotions, too few emotions,
yeah,
and sometimes volatile emotions that come out in a very rebellious way.
Yeah.
And this book can really help them finger what their emotion is.
There is not a lot of healthy mirrors for teenagers right now regarding emotions.
Mm-hmm. So I think this should be on every teacher's desk and in every student lounge, not even to be forcibly pushed at them, but just to be handled and moved around among them. When they're comfortable, they open it up, read, and go further from there.
Mm-hmm.
Or to be used as a facilitator for a discussion.
Great point. So many applications. Now, I know your website is doyougetthefeeling.com. That's the
right
book title.
www. I found if you don't put the www, it doesn't go through.
Oh, really? I thought that
I'm
was...
I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I didn't think we needed to do that anymore.
Yeah, for some reason, it wasn't picking up recently, so you've got to type in the www
okay.
and then dot doyougetthefeeling.com.
Great. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you. You've just conveyed so much information, and this book, I mean, like you said, it just did come out, but I think you are really onto something with it. I believe you will do extremely, extremely well, and I hope that you really get this out to the professional community, and then it just expands from there. So what are you doing right now in regards to that? And then, you know, our time is kind of coming to an end, so I'd like you just to express your final thoughts to our listeners.
Right now, I am actually sending the book out to researchers of emotional intelligence to hear their opinion on it, as well as going onto forums on the website with groups of people who suffer from something called alexithymia, and that's the inability to express themselves. And I've been communicating with them to let them know about this book and how it can help them. And I'm hoping that the response from the researchers and the experts on emotional intelligence and awareness will be positive, that they themselves will get it out to their communities and to their colleges, universities, research centers that can use this book further and expand its value.
Mm-hmm.
And also looking very much to present at social work graduate programs to teach social work students how to use this, clinics, hospitals, any place where this can be applied. I am delighted to present it, to model it, as well as to present more of the research scientifically, which is behind this book. That's pretty much where I'm at.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Celia. It's been great talking with you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate the time, and I'm really excited about this.
Great. We are, too. So good luck and much success to you. All right, listeners, thank you so much for listening today. I've been talking with Celia Raber. Her new book, Do You Get the Feeling, is available through her website, which is the same as the title of the book, www.doyougetthefeeling.com. Also, I believe her book is available through local and online booksellers. So thank you for listening. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.